Welcome to Hellbent, a feminist podcast for those who resist and persist. I'm Varsha.
And I'm Devin. And today on the pod, we are going to start off by talking about the situation of family separation at the border. There's been some very important updates, and they all make my stomach turn. We're also going to talk about Claire McCaskill and the Russian GRU, the intelligence unit, attempting to hack into her campaign. And that also dovetails with another story about how even 19 months into his presidency, there's no one in charge of the election security agency.
Yeah, it's a lot of stuff has happened.
Before we jump in, though, Varsha, how was your weekend?
It was pretty great. I did a lot of fun stuff. I also finalized my paper for my first conference ever. I'm going back to Santa Clara University this Friday to participate in my first history conference. I'm very excited.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I will be talking about Teddy Roosevelt, the press, and the conservation movement. And I came upon this topic really randomly, but I've fallen in love with it this summer, and it's pretty fun.
That is really amazing. I'm so excited for you.
It's really cool because it has it ties into Native American water rights, which is still like an issue up till today. And so I found out like there's this case in 1908 that's still having problems, giving problems to Native Americans and people who aren't Native Americans today. So it's just It's a big mess, and it's pretty cool. Yeah.
Wow,
but how was yours?
I didn't do anything quite that cool, but I did go to a pool party, which I love.
Ooh,
I love pool parties.
Fun.
It's been about 6 million degrees in Los Angeles lately, and it was just really nice to like go to a pool and hang out and just see some friends, and it was a very normal, lovely weekend, which I hadn't had in a while, so...
Yeah, I'm actually jealous of California heat right now because I'm not liking the DC humidity. It's not like that bad, but in a combination of it, like it was raining this past week and it's like hot and sticky and I'm just like, I want to leave so bad. I miss California. Yeah. Okay, Devin, what's been going on at the border?
As I believe we all know, there was a major deadline that the courts had established that required the Trump administration to reunite all of the children that had been taken from their parents under their zero tolerance policy. There were two deadlines. The first one was for children under 5. The second one was for all children in this program. So they completely fucked up the first deadline. They didn't make it. And now technically they have returned all of the children that they have deemed, quote, eligible to be returned to their parents in time for the second deadline. But that means about 1,800 kids, which leaves somewhere between 700 and 900 more kids not reunited with their parents because for whatever reasons they were deemed ineligible to meet this deadline. So that is just top level bullshit there. What has actually also been really horrifying is that Vox was reporting that now the government is attempting to re-separate parents and children again. So there are four fathers who were reunited with their four teenage sons, in accordance with this deadline that was put in place by the court system. When they were reunited, they were given a form that basically had options for their family's cases. So they could either be deported with the child. One could be they could be deported but leave the child there and let the child pursue their own deportation case. The other had been, we're going to wait and consult with a lawyer.
Speak with a lawyer. Yeah.
Apparently, these four men got these forms that had already had one option selected for them. So it was the option that both the parent and child were to be deported together. And when they tried to say, no, we want to do something different, they were yelled at, they were threatened. And ultimately, one father was saying that he decided to let his son pursue his own deportation case since the father had what are known as final orders, which means there are no legal options for an appeal to stay in the country. And so he said, okay, well, I want to at least let my son pursue his case because maybe he'll be able to stay. So they were then separated forcibly and not allowed to say goodbye. And they just drove the kid off on a bus, basically re-traumatizing and re-separating this family hours after they had been reunited because of this bullshit forms situation.
When I was reading this story, I just couldn't believe, like, every sentence just was more and more horrific. It's not just that they are creating this weird, like, Orwellian like system for parents to literally like, it's literally Sophie's Choice, but real life. Like, do you leave your kid behind or do you take them with you to possibly a country where neither of you will be safe? Or do you consult with a lawyer who probably won't be able to help you? Or, and if you do consult a lawyer, are you going to continue to stay in ICE detention where you can't stay with your kids? And even if you can, ICE is literally like messing with you every day, and like threatening you. So there's no good option here. And there's a lot of horrible things you can say about Obama's immigration policy. And you can definitely say that ICE went off the handle during the Obama administration as well. But this is like a level of cruelty I have never seen before. I've never read about before. And it's really bad.
Well, and another, I think, thing that is important to note is that the forms were written mostly in English, and only those three options were at the bottom in Spanish and had been pre-selected. So if English isn't your first language, if you do not speak or read English well or at all, these forms would have been completely useless to you. And all you know is that you have these three options. You have no idea what the rest of the form says. And you have to make a snap second decision about your child that has just been returned to you after months of being separated. I can't imagine the why ICE is doing this. I mean, besides to, as they said in the past, that this is an effort of deterrence. So they're still making that case that this was never intended to traumatize. It was intended to as deterrence, which is an actual steaming pile of horseshit, because we know that there was a study done by
the Center for American Progress, I think.
Yeah, a study done by the Center for American Progress that looked at family separation policies over the years and deterrence policies over the years. Under Obama, their policy was to just detain families indefinitely, but that was supposed to be a deterrent effect as well. And the study basically found that absolutely has never actually deterred anyone, and that if there is deterrence, it is not mathematically measurable. For that, this is not, it's not about deterrence. I don't care what they say.
Yeah, exactly what you just said. Basically, what this study shows, or at least what Vox's reporting shows, is like, by reading the study, it's clear that the Trump administration could have done the study themselves beforehand when they were conducting this pilot program in May, or even before they started this pilot program of family separation, but they just didn't care enough. They literally didn't care about what effect this would have, or if this would have the intended policy consequence that they want. Like, Trump keeps saying over and over again for the past almost 2 years that what he wants is to stop illegal immigration completely, right? And what this proves is that this will not stop it. There is nothing that will stop it, because the reason these people are coming across the border most of the time is because they are literally seeking refuge from countries where they cannot live. I mean, the reason they are trekking across, you know, across other countries with their kids is because they can't stay at home. Like, I don't understand why you would lie about that. And you would suffer a dangerous journey across Mexico, across other South American countries to get to the United States, and then lie that you need asylum, or lie that you need like a legal visa to come here, right? And it's not as if the legal visa process is getting easier either. It's basically the reason that I'm frustrated with this, you know, Trump administration immigration policy, besides the fact that it's cruel, you know, besides the fact that family separation, whether it's on the border, whether it's through the travel ban and all this stuff, is cruel, is that it doesn't actually have the intended policy effect that they want to have. You know, the travel ban is about stopping terrorism. None of these countries have harbored terrorists who attack the United States like directly in the past like 20 years. You know, it has been proven study after study, even by conservative think tanks, that communities that have immigrants in them have less crime, right? So that there's reason for this.
Right. And the lip service they're giving to stopping terrorism or stopping crime. Trump went on a whole tweet storm that I'm not going to link to, because fuck that. But basically saying Democrats don't care. They want open borders and they care very little about crime. And so this linking of immigration to crime is the, like, as you described it, their desired policy outcome. But here's the problem. Like you said, you know, study after study, conservative, liberal, all of these studies show that that's not the case. And so we know that it's not about policy outcome. We know that it's not about an intended or even unintended effect. it's about racism.
Yeah.
And it's about creating a deeply rooted systemic system in which anyone who is not white is othered and dehumanized. Again, we've talked about this so much, that so much of this presidency, so much of the political climate is about dehumanization and doing the work of dehumanizing so that we as a people feel comfortable in taking children away from parents and being able to hold that in our heads while maybe being parents ourselves or knowing that it's wrong. But because they've done so much work to dehumanize these other people, it doesn't feel as wrong as it should.
I was rewatching The West Wing, and there was this conservative person on the show, and this show is from the 90s. It's like, or early 2000s, right? And someone is like, oh yeah, Democrats just want open borders and they want to let criminals in. And I remembered, oh, like this is not like a brand new thing Trump has come up with. This is something Republicans have shifted. They've shifted their policy on immigration for the past few years into more extreme versions of what they believed in under the Clinton era. And it's getting worse and worse. And I totally agree with people who are saying that Trump has made this completely worse. But the thing is, even Ted Cruz, before Trump was even on the scene, doesn't support the DREAM Act. Right. There are people who claim to be Republicans like better immigration. If you watch, you know, Reagan and H.W. Bush talking about immigration in the 80s, they loved immigration because that is just a conservative value, is that, you know, immigration helps increase, economic activity in the United States. But now they've found a way to basically convince their white working class base, or their white base, even if they're not working class, if they're middle class, rich, whatever, that we are helping you by letting you keep your status, your racial status or your social status, by harming people who are brown. That is just proof. And there are studies after studies that show that, like, that, the 2016 election and also other things that have been happening when it comes to racial justice in the United States are never about economic anxiety. This is never about jobs. This is never about crime. This is never about national security. This is about maintaining social status of white people.
Well, yeah, there was the whole thing in The Atlantic that was basically saying that if you went and talked to people who voted for Trump, who were, who were assumed to be voting for economic anxiety reasons, they even would tell you, no, it was because I didn't want to lose my racial status, my white privilege was basically what they were voting to protect.
Yep. And the thing is, we continue this narrative, though, because if you look at it, the way the media is reporting on these family separations, at least the way the public is receiving it, they focus a lot on the fact that Trump voters sometimes say, don't try to make me cry with pictures of sad babies. And like continue to give Trump voters this platform as if like they're the only people who matter. White people who don't care about children being separated from their families, the only people who matter. And then simultaneously discredit the fact that there were protests in the streets across the country against this policy. And so it's a continuation that we just continue to venerate this notion that Trump has won the white working class and expand it as if that white working class is the only working class, and they're the only kind of voter we should care about, and they're the only kind of person we should care about, the only kind of person whose family is worth keeping together. And so that's how it all boils down to, is that Trump is doing this, one, because he is personally racist, but two, because, you know, even though Stephen Miller is personally racist, he knows this is going to win him an election, or this is going to help him win an election. And it's horrific.
Right, because it worked before. It's horrific. I also would like to point out part of Vox's reporting and talking about what reunification of these kids and why, you know, you would choose to maybe be deported and leave your kid there. So one of the reasons is because when they separated these kids, like I've been harping on, is that they were reclassified as unaccompanied alien children or unaccompanied minors. That's how they're recorded in the government. So this recent reclassification is important because that means it changes your status in the government and generates its own case file. So I don't know exactly what that means right now. In the coming weeks, that I want to be paying more attention to that. But I do want to point out that part of what's going on with this reunification has to do with reclassifying these kids as unaccompanied minors.
Yeah. And I just really hope that there is someone still in DHS who thinks this is horrible. I did see someone did resign and sent a letter to Kirstjen Nielsen. I forget the name of this person. This amazing woman resigned, and she sent a letter of her resignation. And the last line said, "It is you who should be resigning because of your policies, but I am the one sending a letter." And so, like, there are a couple of people. There was this one ICE agent in San Francisco or California, I think, who decided to resign and talk about what ICE has been asking him to do. But there hasn't been an en masse, like, exodus from the White House, at least within ICE and DHS. And that's just even scarier, because 5 years from now, when there are hearings about this administration, what they did to immigrants in Congress, all these people are just going to say, "I was following orders," and we're going to rehabilitate them. And that's what's horrible is, like, you know, Kirstjen Nielsen, 3 years from now, when she's out of a job and hopefully there's a Democratic president, she's going to manage to get a job at some think tank or something, and we're going to end up rehabilitating her, right? Because she's going to say, "I was just following orders," or she's going to pretend in a book that she's going to have ghostwritten that, "Oh, I didn't really support the policy and blah, 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 blah." But no one's going
to
believe her.
But they will allow, they'll allow themselves to believe her because they want to, again, this like very deep rooted white privilege wants to believe that that's somehow the natural order, and that these people who are actors are just following orders. I know you don't love Holocaust comparisons, and I don't necessarily either, but, like, I mean, that was what the Nuremberg trials were about. Yeah. Was separating, and I'm going to make a super geeky reference here, y'all, but, you know, in Harry Potter, a lot of people after Voldemort was in power the first time around, you know, a lot of people, once he was vanquished and these Death Eaters came out and said, "Oh, we were under the Imperius Curse," which is basically a mind control spell. And so they were trying to basically say, "Oh, I was just following orders," or "It wasn't even me. I was just being controlled."
Yeah.
And
the reason that is actually a perfect analogy, though, is because, again, Harry Potter in the fourth book shows that you can throw off the Imperius Curse. So does Barty Crouch. Like, you can escape the Imperius Curse if you really want to, if you are strong enough in your personal will. And so that is what people who are actually resigning their political posts because they actually disagree with what this president is doing is saying. It's like, this is not just politics. I think the reason I'm so bothered by people like Sean Spicer getting a book deal and being allowed a book tour is because we are saying, oh, what he did for almost a year as press secretary was just politics. No, it wasn't. It really wasn't.
Right.
He,
well, so it goes back to, like, sexually, like, men who sexually abuse women getting apology tours and reigniting their careers or whatever. I think that's why it bothers me so much, is it smacks of that, like, oh, well, I did this, but, like, it was just this one thing and it's not that big of a deal. And now just, like, take me back, give me more money. It's fine. Like, I'm a different person. It's like, no, you're not.
Yeah. I think that's what bothers me, is that, like, there are a bunch of outlets that are still covering the story. It's still a giant story. But I am so worried, just like the travel ban, this is going to turn into a just politics story, right? Because with the travel ban, what happened was it was passed, like, the first weekend after Trump became president, and there were protests. People were angry for weeks. And then when the Ninth Circuit, like, shut it down, and a bunch of different courts, like, shut it down, they came up with a new one, and then a new one again. And finally, by the time they had the third one, which is deemed constitutional by the Supreme Court, no one really cared anymore, except the people who were directly affected. And I am happy that the story is still in the news, because it is really important and it is scary. And there are still hundreds of kids who don't have their parents, but I'm worried at some point it will not be in the news and we will forget about it. And it will seem as if it was just Trump who did this, but it could be another Republican in the future, right? It could be, there has to be consequences for this. And, you know,
Well, no, I like how you said that, though. Like, this policy did not come out of nowhere.
Yeah.
And it has been a basically a work in progress, a shifting of Republican ideology to create a more white nationalist party platform. And a huge part of that, in order to create that sort of policy platform, is you have to have this component of quote unquote illegal immigration.
Yeah.
And this idea that immigrants that are from quote undesirable quote shithole countries, and actual fucking quote by our president, that we somehow have to vilify that type of immigration. And so this is just an extension of that. And like you said, I mean, especially the way that these news stories are framing it, there is a lot about, oh, this is, talking about policy outcomes, talking about like test runs and how it was supposed to be deterrence. And all of that language is basically wrapping it up in a bubble of, what's the word I'm looking for? It's wrapping it in a layer of protection.
Yeah, just like a layer
because
of
you can say, oh, this was just a political layer of normalcy. Exactly. That it's, oh, this is just politics as normal. When we have to stop and step back and say, no, this is not politics as normal. This is not normal. This is not policy. This is not about our country and creating a better country. This is about creating a racist, top-down autocracy.
Yeah, it really is, because it is about, because the way that Trump talks about this, it really fits into how he talked right after he met with Kim Jong-un about how people in Kim Jong-un's country like salute the leader as soon as he comes in and say nice things about him. Like the fact that he doesn't accept, Trump doesn't accept dissent within his White House is not because like, not just because he has a big ego, but he truly believes that he should be able to control every single aspect of policy top down, and no one can have any other say in it, right? There can be no type of debate. Right. And this is how this policy has been enacted. The separation policy was enacted through executive power, which Republicans seem to hate when Obama was president, but now are like, oh, I don't really care about it. We, you know, what power does Congress have? It's not like we're a separate government or a separate, like, constitutional power that can check the presidency. It's like they're lame to do anything. You know, when it came to the DREAM Act, the travel ban, family separation, the Republicans have done nothing. And by doing nothing, by continuing just to be like, have furrowed brows and shake their heads, you're right. They're just coding this in a layer of normalcy, as if this is just normal politics. This is how the executive branch should conduct policy. But this was not a normal policy.
Right.
As that study shows by the guy at UCSD, when it was published by Center for American Progress, there was no policy basis behind this. There was no actual study done to prove that this would actually be a deterrent. This was purely out of cruelty. And even the idea of it being a deterrent is a disgusting policy outcome. Because these people,
yeah, as if it's somehow better. Like, oh, it was supposed to be a deterrent, and so that's somehow okay. No, fuck you. It is not okay to use real people's real lives, real bodies, real children to deter you from anything. That is just a load of shit, yeah. And I am so sick of it. And I am so sick of it, even in progressive outlets and. This story has stayed in the news longer than I thought it would, and it keeps getting brought up. But there's still this disgusting sliminess around it, where they're like, oh, as if you can justify the nexus, right? Like, oh, it was just supposed to be deterrence. It was supposed to work, and it didn't, and this just like got out of control. Like, no, someone should have canceled this idea like the second it was out of someone's mouth. And that goes for Obama's administration and family detention centers as deterrence. Someone should have shut that shit down too. And so it's frustrating that it takes babies to get us to say, maybe this isn't just about crime.
Yeah. I mean, I think somebody asked me like recently, because I'm really for abolishing ICE right now. They're like, when did you like turn so left? I thought you were like a centrist pragmatist. I'm like, yeah, I'm still a fucking pragmatist. If you asked me tomorrow to look at like a Medicare for All bill or a plan to abolish ICE or whatever, I will still want to know how we're going to pay for it, what we're going to do with all the people who will lose their jobs, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But I'm still going to share my values. Like, even though like, people like a certain senator from Vermont bother me, I still believe everyone should have healthcare. I don't like certain ways that we have gone about talking about it. I don't like certain ways that people have attacked, politicians for not outright supporting the most outlandish idea with no nuance. I still believe in nuance, but I also believe in my values, right? And I think the Republican Party has shown that their value is, I don't give a fuck about kids unless they're white. And the Democratic Party's value is, ICE is evil. They're creating baby jails. We'll figure out how to pay for abolishing ICE later. We'll figure out how to deal with people who lose their jobs later. We'll figure out how to actually create the policy later, but we're going to campaign on it now because this is fucking evil.
Well, yeah, like you can triage. Like you can triage a little bit here, right? You can say like this needs to happen now. And then we can triage what's important in the outcomes of that policy. And that is a perfectly respectable way to create policy. That's how almost all policy is created, is you start with the idea, you move down to the granular, and you triage what's most important. And so for people to say like, oh, this has to be 100% flushed out, like, it really doesn't. It needs to be like a little bit fleshed out, but like have a fucking spine. Yeah. Like you said, I know people are always super, super confused when they find out that I am not for a certain senator's from Vermont's plan for Medicare for all. And I'm like, it's not because I don't think people deserve healthcare. I think it's because we need to be realistic about the current capitalist market society in which we live and just how much you can change that with a single bill.
The way to bring this full circle back to what the GOP or what Trump did with this family separation policy is when you have like, they had an idea. Their idea was, let's be as cruel as humanly possible, but we have this one policy goal we want to achieve. We want to stop illegal immigration or illegal border crossings, right? What they did instead was just do the cruel shit. They did like the expansive Medicare for All bill version of cruel baby jails, except it didn't accomplish their goal of giving anybody healthcare or actually ending illegal immigration, right? And so what someone could have done who wanted to actually end border crossings or actually examine the asylum system was give every single person who crossed the border and their families, instead of throwing them in jail, throwing them in the detention centers, we could have actually given them ankle bracelets so we can track them and so they can get back to their court cases. That is an actual policy idea that has the nuance to do what the Trump administration wanted and to not put kids in jail, right? So that's the kind of like...
Right. Well, but that's also how we know that wasn't the goal. There was no policy outcome that was really being pursued. So yeah, a little bit of triage, a little bit of nuance. Everyone goes home happy. All right, Varsha. So there's already evidence that Russia is meddling in the 2018 midterm. So it looks like Claire McCaskill's campaign was unsuccessfully hacked, though she hasn't actually spoken to what happened, just that something did occur. And according to reporting, no information was stolen and they did not actually hack into the campaign. So can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah. So basically, she is one of the most vulnerable senators running for re-election. She's running in a state that Trump won. And basically, a week before this happened, or literally, I think a day before this happened, Trump said, no, Russia is not going to continue targeting us. I think Kirstjen Nielsen said, no, it doesn't seem that Russians are just trying to get Republicans win or just trying to get Donald Trump to win, right? And then this happened. And basically, they tried to hack into, I think, the staffer's emails. And it was the Russian GRU, which is their intelligence service. And they tried to hack into the emails and try to get information about what's going on internally and do the same thing they did with Podesta, the DNC, et cetera, do it all over again.
I want to take a quick second to just actually talk a little bit about the method here, because I think it's important. And I feel like it's also something that a lot of people didn't understand about the coverage during the 2016 campaign. Mm-hmm. So what they did is something called spear phishing, which basically what they do is they send you an email that says your password has been compromised and it needs to be reset, your email password. And so then you click on a link and it takes you to a very convincing, very official looking page that says, okay, enter the new password for your email address here. And if you're not looking for it, and if you don't have something like two-factor authentication set up, then when you submit that form, it's not actually for your Gmail account, or in this case, it was for Microsoft Exchange email. It then sends your password to the Russian government. And that's what happened with Podesta, is that he clicked the link and to quote unquote reset his password. It looked like it was the Gmail password reset screen. If you looked very carefully at the link, at the text, you would have noticed that it wasn't actually officially Gmail, which is why two-factor authentication, which is when you change your password, you then get a text to your phone that says, okay, you have to add this in to make sure so that you don't get caught in spear phishing campaigns. So, and why is that important? It's pretty technical, I know. It has more to do with the fact that this is not a super complicated endeavor. And in fact, pretty much anyone can do it. And they're repeating methods. So that just goes to show you what the GRU thinks of our election security. And I know that seems a little obtuse, but it's important if subtle point.
Yeah. And so they're basically trying it the same exact way. And we don't know if the next senator or the next House candidate is going to be as lucky. And again, I just want to repeat this. We don't know if it's going to be a Democrat again. I know Donald Trump is trying to pretend that Putin didn't want him to win, but I don't know. In the future, Putin might not want a Republican to win. So this is really important to focus on.
Yeah, this is important for everyone. And like I said, it is a very basic type of hacking. Like this is literally anyone with 2 hours and a little bit of coding knowledge could do. You know, what I also think is important here is that this was caught also in part by Microsoft. And so Microsoft then sued the hackers as John Doe defendants. The court then established a process that like lets Microsoft take over any web address the hackers use that includes a Microsoft trademark. So basically, by suing them, Microsoft now has some more power to take down these websites and to have some control over this operation. But that just means, you know, you build a better mousetrap, the mouse gets smarter. So that means that maybe there won't be another spear phishing attempt. There's going to be another type of hacking attempt, and people just need to be very aware of what's going on. I also want to take a hot second to talk about the fact that it's Claire McCaskill. Like you said, she's probably the most vulnerable Democratic senator. She's from Missouri, which is a very red state. You know, she's been very outspoken against Russia. She's very liberal. Obviously, they want her seat. So, but it's also another woman. And I'm not going to sit here and be like, everything is because, you know, man, woman, whatever. But we know that Putin hates strong women. We knew that Trump hates straight strong women. And we know that Democrats are running more and more women every year. And so there is an absolute gender bias here
that
Claire McCaskill was one of the first who was targeted, not just because she's in a vulnerable seat, but because she is a strong, outspoken woman who doesn't take any shit. And that pisses all of the men who are in power off. And that is part of this. And I don't care if it doesn't seem super, it's not super obvious, but it is very obvious to me that there is a gender component here. And as Democrats continue to run more and more women, more strong women, more progressive women, this is going to be an issue.
Yeah, because it's also about how we talk about this attack, because in 2016, the way we talked about it and the way we've talked about it since, as if Hillary Clinton's campaign was so incompetent that they fell for this attack. But if you look at what happened to John Podesta, it wasn't because he was incompetent. Yes, you should have two-factor authentication. Yes, there should have been more security, but he was still a victim. The campaign itself was still a victim. Hillary Clinton's campaign was still a victim. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, whatever you may think of her, was still a victim. Again, like I agree with you, Devin, like maybe we can't make this all about gender bias, but I truly believe the way we discuss about women being victims and men being victims is so already crappy in the media when it comes to other issues of like other types of attacks that of course it's going to be shitty this way. And so I'm happy to see that like this time around when Claire McCaskill was attacked, like no one made it seem as if it was the campaign's fault. And I think that was because they were unsuccessful. Who knows, if they were successful, maybe we would have seen a repeat of the same narrative that happened in 2016. I think the fact that McCaskill is a woman would have played into that.
I absolutely think so. And I just think it's really important to keep our eye on that particular piece of this puzzle because yeah, like you said, there's an element of being a victim of an attack like this, and we already punish women for being victims. And so, you know, I can see a narrative spinning where Claire McCaskill is somehow weaker just because she was the victim of an attack. Her campaign was the victim of the attack. Like somehow it's her fault that she was chosen as a target and that it's somehow going to twist around to be her fault. Like you said, if it were successful, maybe we wouldn't be as sympathetic right now. And I do really think that there is something to be said about, you know, people were like, oh yeah, John Podesta, he was a victim of this, but ultimately Hillary's campaign was seen in such a poor light because they were attacked by an outside force and they had no control over that.
Or like the fact that, oh, Hillary Hillary Clinton's like internal campaign emails or and the DNC emails shouldn't have been so outrageous at all. And I'm like, how were they outrageous? I think I remember one email about a creme brulee recipe, or no, getting creme brulee with Huma Abedin. I remember another email about John Podesta's risotto. So I don't understand, like, yeah. You know, so I am very sad that I don't know Claire McCaskill's favorite risotto recipe, but I am happy that her staffers that I were better at security. I mean, I think this all comes to the fact that even the Trump administration isn't doing anything about this, because it's been around 20 months into the Trump presidency, and there isn't a single person or agency that is in charge of combating foreign election interference. Donald Trump can't even admit right. that it's going to happen again in 2018. You have to beg Sarah Huckabee Sanders to admit this. Only Dan Coats, even though he won't resign for some reason, is willing to admit the fact that Russia is going to do this again, and some other intelligence officials, but they're not doing anything to fix it. And this goes back to, I think right. this was sometime in 2017, I think it was Coats or Rogers. They were at a hearing and they asked, the senators asked, you know, what are you doing to combat this from stopping again? And I think Rogers or Coats says, we haven't gotten a say from the White House to do this. And it's still right. the case. Basically, even though his Trump's national security cabinet have acknowledged the fact it has to be like a central unifying force against this happening in 2018, no one's been doing any work. Like, the work has been split up across the Department of Homeland Security, National Security Council, and a bunch of other agencies, but no one has like actually hunkered down to figure out what the central response is. And Congress is not really willing to act, even though Democrats really want to, even though certain Republicans want to, they're not doing shit about it. And I really think the reason they're not doing shit about it is because this goes to the fact that I heard something really horrible on a TV show the other day. Rudy Giuliani was like, it's not like collusion isn't really a crime, so there's nothing really to talk about right now. We have gone from, in 2016, people like Giuliani saying Trump campaign never had any contact with any Russians, to 2018 Giuliani saying collusion isn't really a crime. Soon they're going to be saying, the GOP is going to be saying, we were so smart to get information from Russia to beat the Democrats. We're just better, you know, we're just better at electioneering than Democrats. Like, they're going to accept this. Just like there's a layer of normalcy around putting kids in baby jails, they're going to put a layer of normalcy around getting foreigners to intervene in our elections and destabilizing our election system.
Yeah, well, I mean, and that's the problem. And again, it's sort of part of the reason why I brought up the type of attack used here. A spear phishing campaign is very basic and does not take a lot to combat. But the fact of the matter is that Congress is zeroing out the budget to give states money to have basic protections against this kind of stuff. I mean, we're talking about campaigns and we're talking about like email stuff, but then there's the actual voter systems themselves. Like, we know that those were hacked in 2016 as well. And it wasn't necessarily changing the votes that were in. It was saying, oh, you're not registered to vote because it was hacked and they were deleting people off voter rolls. I mean, it's not just campaign. It's not just a campaign issue.
The theory around Putin's election meddling from the beginning has been he started this initially just to fuck with the elections and to mess up Hillary Clinton when she won. And then it became, oh my God, Donald Trump could actually win. Let's help him win, right? And so now he wants to continue that initial process of just messing with our election system. Because I know that the Cold War is over, but Putin still believes that democracy itself is like a failure. And he wants to prove that to the world. And the way to prove that to the world is to show the world's oldest democracy collapsing on itself because it no longer has faith in its elections.
I am going to stand for this article that came out in early 2017 in The New Yorker called Cold War 2.0. I think everyone should go find it and read it immediately, because it's basically saying, no, the Cold War is not over. It's just different now. We're not fighting about nukes. We're fighting about information and hacking and whose elections can withstand meddling.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is it's obvious that we can't, and that this administration is uniquely disinterested, because they know that they benefited from it. And it's just short-sighted, because, you know, Putin isn't a Republican. So once Republicans are not helpful to his cause anymore, he will change tacks. But the fact of the matter is they know that it helps them. And the part of the goal outside of Russian interference is to purge voter rolls of Black people and people of color, and is to disenfranchise, you know, poor people and women. And that's the ultimate goal. And so right now, Russia is serving into those goals. And so, of course, they're not trying that hard because they know that this is a means to their end. And they don't care that those means could spell the collapse of major democratic institutions, if not democracy itself.
The one thing that bothers me is there's like a lot of pundits out there who will say whenever the Russia stuff comes up, oh, Donald Trump just has a big ego and he doesn't like conflating the fact that election meddling happened because he thinks it ruins faith in his election victory. That's one thing. That is true. That's fine. Trump has a big ego and he's not that bright. But it can also be true that he knows that Donald Trump Jr. tried to get dirt on Hillary Clinton. He knows, a part of him knows that Russia and WikiLeaks helped him. And a part of him knows this is one way I can get reelected again. It's the same thing with, exactly. Like, remember that tape, that recording came out of Paul Ryan joking about the fact that Putin pays Rohrabacher and Trump, right? Like, Paul Ryan, yep, fucking knows that Putin helped the Republican Party. And Paul Ryan was willing to give up his firm Russia hawkness against Russia, his firm like cold warriorness to win an election. Like Mitch McConnell, same thing. Like Mitch McConnell knew about election meddling in 2016 when Obama told him, and he threatened Obama to say, and if he said anything, he threatened Obama, and he would not sign on to Obama telling the public that this was happening. Like, they know that this is giving them power, and they're going to continue doing it as long as it gives them power. And you're right, Devin, it's short-sighted, because we have no idea what Putin could want, you know, 5 years from now, 2 years from now, even. We have no idea what the next, Russian president could want, because I, for all I know, Putin isn't immortal. If he is immortal, then we're just screwed for eternity. But at this point, like, we are under the assumption that he is mortal, and the next Russian president, who could be some other corrupt official, could want something different, right? And God forbid 5-10 years from now the Democratic majority leader is in cahoots with Russia and no one helps the Republicans, right? Like, I don't think that would happen, because I think we have better values, as we've discussed before, but you never know. So McConnell should really stop being short-sighted about this, because clearly Trump isn't going to be. So you have to at least turn to the Republicans in Congress and be like, what are you doing? You firmly believe in representative democracy, even though you like purging voter rolls of poor people and African Americans. You believe that you were elected. Are you really going to let another country mess with this election? It's bananas.
If you're like me, the list of books that you want to read, or books that people suggest you should read, is never ending and always expanding. I simply don't have time to read them all, and so our sponsor, Blinkist, has solved your long list of must-reads once and for all. Blinkist is the only app that takes thousands of the best-selling nonfiction books and distills them down to their most impactful elements, so you can read or listen to them in under 15 minutes, all on your phone. I've started listening to Blinkist while I do the dishes. I hate doing the dishes, but lately I've been excited for the 15 minutes of relative silence I can use to catch up on books that I'm still lying about myself that I'm going to sit down and read. The Blinkist library is massive. From timeless classics to Think and Grow Rich to current bestsellers like Fire and Fury, which was super interesting, and the 15-minute gist of the book really captured the chaos that is the White House. And this is really great for those of us into politics. It just takes these essential ideas from nonfiction books and just uses that to get our brains tingling and give us more power in the political space. I also recently listened to the 15-minute digest of The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, a book that's been on my Kindle for months. So getting that 15 minutes in made me really want to sit down and read the whole thing. Blinkist is constantly curating and adding new titles from best of lists, so you're also getting the most powerful ideas in a made-for-mobile format. Right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for Hellions. Go to Blinkist.com/hellbent to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan when you join today. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T. Blinkist.com/hellbent to start your free trial or get 3 months off your yearly plan. Blinkist.com/hellbent.
Okay, Devin, what are you grateful for this week?
I'm grateful for one other thing that might be great, might be horrible, who knows, but I was invited to the world premiere screening of Dinesh D'Souza's new movie, Death of a Nation, in which he compares Trump to Abraham Lincoln and how they are both brave American heroes who are being attacked by Democrats for what they believe in. And it's up to the country to rally around Trump to create the greatest nation on earth and avoid the death of our nation. The poster is a picture. It's half Lincoln, half Trump. It's really awful. I was invited personally. And so I was like, yes, I will take press credentials. Thank you. So tomorrow, Tuesday, I am going to see the premiere screening of Death of a Nation. And I will be interviewing people who worked on the film. I'm going to be asking some very pointed and serious questions. I will be Facebook Living as much of it as I can. If anyone has any suggestions or wants me to ask anything of Dinesh D'Souza or the team for this movie, I'd be happy to hear it. I have no shame. And so I'm going to read them the, you know, so because by inviting me, they either A, didn't do their homework, or B, don't care, or C, it's always both. So it's both. But I have every intention of making this a very unpleasant situation because this is bullshit. Yeah. And I'm very, very excited to call racists racist to their face.
I mean, one thing I'm also like, sorry to go off on the gratefulness, but I have loved Twitter for the past few months, which is a weird statement. I know Twitter sometimes is the worst, but there's this hashtag called Twitterstorians, and that's like Twitter historians. And it's like the community of historians on Twitter who just talk about history and stuff like that. And a bunch of them, I've started following more and more of them, and starting with like Kevin Cruz and a bunch of others, they've just been like dragging Dinesh D'Souza on like a weekly and daily basis. And I love it so much. I realized how awesome this community was when Senator Sasse's old history professor dragged him on Twitter for being wrong about the Constitution last year. And then they've been just messing with people who are getting history wrong. And I love being a part of it. It's so awesome. But Dinesh D'Souza's history is just so bad. And like on a serious note, it's really bad that he gets to, you know, he gets to produce this movie and like pretend it's like a work of serious scholarship in some communities. And because he literally is trying to rewrite history to make it seem as if not just Democrats are the quote unquote real racists, but that Trump actually emulates the kind of republicanism of Lincoln and then later on Reagan. It's not true. And it's just, not only is it bad history, it really messes with how people understand how history even works. And so like as a nerd, I'm offended. But also as an American, I'm offended. And also, last thing, Death of a Nation is like in reference to the movie Birth of a Nation, racist as fuck.
I know. I'm actually just really looking forward to just reading them for felt. I'm really looking forward to it. Like I said, Hellions, if you have any suggestions for questions or things you'd like me to say, I would be more than happy to do that. So get in contact with us.
That would be, I would love to hear their answers. I mean, I just want them to answer the main question, which is if Democrats are the quote unquote real racists, why does David Duke support the Republican Party? Just tell me that. Right? Like it makes no sense. I really love working on this project. And that is definitely one thing I'm grateful for this week. I like the fact that we started like the newsletter again, and that I love doing research on Sundays for this. This has made my past year a lot better. I think it's coming up almost a year working with you and Sarah on Hellbent, and it's been great. And I am also grateful for one other thing. As people listening probably know, Sean Spicer released a book. You probably haven't bought it because it's bad. It got like horrible reviews all across. Like the Wall Street Journal, I think, called him like prove that he just made up stuff in the book, right?
I know.
And so he was doing like a book event or something at some store in New York, and someone started heckling him and basically was like, you're a liar, you've been lying for like, you lied for your whole time during a press secretary. And they got kicked out, but they didn't let him be shrouded in a layer of normalcy, and I'm just really grateful for that. because, you know, it's been a while since we talked about the fact that administration officials are being heckled in restaurants, but people are still doing it. They're still like not letting this happen. And recently there was also a Customs and Border Patrol official who was giving a talk at some think tank, and like they were being filmed, and a bunch of people heckled him, and they were like, shame on you. And like one after another, somebody cited the Emma Lazarus poem on the Statue of Liberty. Somebody else was like, you know, how long does it take to forget like the tears of like children and like the sound of children crying? Like they just wouldn't let him speak. And the same thing happened to Sean Spicer. And I'm just really happy that people aren't sitting down for this shit. That makes me feel really grateful and really like welcome here, because this past week was messy when it comes to when you think about like immigration and stuff. So it was good to see that. It was good to see those videos.
Yeah. I think one of my favorite reviews of Sean Spicer's book was, it was a lot like his time at the White House, short and full of lies.
So good.
Okay, Varsha, so who is the dickwad of the week?
So the dickwad of the week is Jeff Sessions.
He's a goddamn frequent flyer in this section, I swear to God.
He really is. He's done a lot of horrible stuff. You know, he was a racist before he was attorney general. He spearheaded this no zero tolerance policy when it comes to separating kids at the border. But recently, he was giving a speech to a group of conservative high school students at a conference organized by Turning Point USA, which is a pro-Trump group. And these kids spontaneously started shouting, lock her up, which is horrific in itself that young kids are now being so like, so convinced that this is how like law enforcement should work, that they are now chanting lock her up. But then he joined in and chanted lock her up and talked about how, oh, I haven't heard that in so long. And he like joked about it, right? And I don't know if anybody else realizes the problem here, but he is the nation's top law enforcement official.
Yeah.
The fundamental basis of our law enforcement or our criminal justice system, even though it is not equally provided to people of different races and socioeconomic classes, is that you are innocent until proven guilty. And guess what? Hillary Clinton went through giant ass investigation that basically cost her the presidency, and it showed that she was innocent. She has not been charged with anything because they can't pin anything on her because she is innocent. So the notion that our top like law enforcement official would join in on this chant, like not when he was campaigning before when he was a senator, because even then it was horrible in 2016 when he was a senator and chanting this, but now as the attorney general is disgusting. It would literally be as if I was another Harry Potter reference. It would be like Dumbledore chanting go Gryffindor at every Quidditch match, right, which he basically did, but you're not supposed to do it out loud.
Right. Right. Like be better at being terrible. Thanks.
Yeah.
Here's the thing. This also, I know this is a kind of an odd connection to make, but this actually reminded me a lot of the abuse allegations against Eric Schneiderman, because Eric Schneiderman was the New York AG and that state's top law enforcement agent. And so he basically thought of himself as above the law. And what made his abuse so much more terrifying was that there was nowhere for these women to turn because he was the law. He was the person that was supposed to enforce laws and help them. And so I feel like this is not the same thing. This is not to say that this is a sexual abuse or that, but the problem that it is that because Sessions is the top law enforcement official in the United States, there is no recourse to this. Like he tried to walk this back and say, oh, well, I probably should have said that, you know, I shouldn't have encouraged them. I should have said you're presumed innocent until proven guilty, but he didn't. And so what that means is that the top law enforcement official in this country does not necessarily believe that. And that is a terrifying authoritarian thought, because Russia likes to lock up political opponents and murder journalists. And that's what the Syrian regime does. Like authoritarian, totalitarian, North Korea is another example. of places where you lock up political opponents and that you indoctrinate young children, like high schoolers, to see that as okay. Because that's the other thing that really bothered me about this, is that these were high schoolers. These are kids who believe that that is okay. And so what's going to happen in 10 years, 20 years, 25 years, when they maybe start running for office and they think it's okay to lock up political opponents or people that you disagree with? How does that change? And
Or at the very least, like, be glib about it, right? Because there was also this troubling video of two kids who are much younger than high school. They were like, I don't know, 10 or 12. And they were, the reporter asked them, they're wearing these red MAGA hats. And there was a video going around Twitter, and the reporter asked them, like, why don't we want, you know, Mexican people or immigrants in the country? And they were basically honest in their racism. And they're learning this from their parents, who are repeating this from the Trump campaign or from Donald Trump himself, right? So we are just... It is just so, like, so horrible that this is how, this is the impression that America is leaving on its kids, or at least this is the impression this administration is leaving on its kids. And the fact that the top law enforcement official, again, no matter how horrible he is, wouldn't, like, stand up, even though this was his political opponent before, or even though this was a Democrat, and say, we are innocent until proven guilty, is really bad. Because I will say one thing. If he is at some point, I really wish, but if he is at some point prosecuted for lying to the Senate, like, I would still believe Jeff Sessions is innocent until proven guilty. Like, even though I personally believe that he lied to the Senate, he still has the complete right to make his case in front of a jury and decide, and the jury gets to decide if he is innocent, right? If tomorrow it comes out that Donald Trump definitely violated campaign finance laws, like, I still believe that when the House eventually impeaches him, he still has a right to a trial in the Senate, right? We have certain, we have a rule of law in this country. And I think Sessions really just showed his cards there, because he's been quote unquote, like, above the law in the way that he's conducting his attorney general's office and who he is prioritizing when it comes to civil rights abuses, when it comes to people being murdered by cops, when it comes to other things in the attorney general's office. But this is just clear as day that he doesn't care what the rule of law means, as long as it's his people benefiting from the rule of law.
Well, and it's really to make Trump happy. That's what he wanted, right? He knows that Trump is not pleased with him. And the only reason he still has a job, I believe, is because of this zero tolerance, you know, family separation policy. And so he knew that it would make Trump happy to hear lock her up and for Jeff Sessions to go along with it. And so that also just shows he doesn't care about anything but himself. And he doesn't care about the rule of law, and he doesn't care about what these kids are learning and what that means for the future of our country and what that means for the future of democracy. And it's just fucking horrifying. The fact that we even used a chant like lock her up during the campaign is so indicative of the Democratic slippage that had already occurred by that point.
Yeah.
Because again, locking up your political opponent is something that Russia does, and North Korea and Syria. That's not what the United fucking States does. And that we have become so okay with it is really the scariest part of all. There was some gender coding going on here too.
Yeah.
Because it was like, the for a woman to have the audacity to think that she could be president, and so she must be doing something wrong. Yeah. There must be something that is propelling this self-aggrandizing belief.
Yeah.
I mean, I feel like that was also part of it, where it's like, this woman is, to use a term that I hate, but this woman is so hysterical that she thinks she could be president that we need to lock her up.
Yeah.
And it's not just about these fictitious crimes or, you know, these investigations that went nowhere. But it was like, it almost felt grosser than that. It almost felt like we need to lock her up, because why would we let a woman be president?
Yeah.
And especially towards the end of the campaign, and especially now, bringing this chant back up, that's what it often feels like, because Hillary Clinton isn't even being investigated currently. And so it feels more like we should lock her up for having the audacity to run for president. Okay, Varsha, last but not least, what are some action items? So something Hellions can do after they listen to the show.
So the first thing that you can do is you can pick up the phone and call your senator and tell them to vote no on Kavanaugh for the Supreme Court. And the reason I think everyone should still do this, even though you, if you think it's a done deal, is because it's not. Recent polling shows that Kavanaugh has one of the lowest approval ratings ever seen for a Supreme Court nominee. He has similar ratings to Bork, who failed, and other nominees who didn't get through and were put on the Supreme Court. So even though, like, you can think that McConnell is going to do anything he can to get Kavanaugh on the court, you should still try every single day to call your senator, because it's not just abortion rights that are on the table. It is just the fundamental fabric of how we vote, because Kavanaugh does not support the Voting Rights Act. It is how we think of our unions. It is how we think of basically anything that we think is fair.
It's how we think of putting a president on the stand. And, you know, Kavanaugh doesn't believe that the Nixon decision was proper and that he shouldn't have been charged. So this is a very important person that needs to never be on the Supreme Court. And not even McConnell can fight numbers this low at some point.
Exactly.
Honestly, the only other person to have numbers like this was withdrawn as a nominee. So, no, I mean, McConnell is a sentient, uncircumcised penis, but he's not magic. So if these numbers trend this way, and if we can really put some pressure on our representatives, we could stop this. The next one is also, you know, we were talking about it a lot today. There is still a huge issue with kids at the border being separated from parents. There are still 900 children that were deemed, quote, ineligible to be reunited with their parents by the deadline. So donating to organizations like Racist Texas, which provides legal support on the ground at these centers, you know, that is still a very important thing to do. Well, all right, Hellions, that is it for us. Thank you so much for listening. I will be back here on Thursday with a very special guest and a report on what happened at Dinesh D'Souza's Death of a Nation screening. It should be very interesting. Look for that on Facebook Live. You know, and until then, raise some hell and remember to be kind. Thank you.